Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio, The Axe Files. With your host, David Axelrod.
Anyone who listens to this podcast knows that I have a special and very personal interest in mental health. So I want to replay one of the first episodes of The Axe Files from way back in 2015. It's with Alistair Campbell, who was the communications guru behind former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. In it, Alistair, who has written several brilliant books and spoken widely on the subject, speaks movingly about his own battles with mental illness. And yes, we talk politics as well, including the candidacy of Donald Trump, who is just beginning his improbable climb to the presidency. Here's our throwback episode of The Axe Files. Alistair Campbell, journalist, political strategist, author, sports nut. You've stolen my identity, and I'm very angry about it.
Yeah, I've still got hair.
Oh, God. You know, this is a podcast. They didn't know until this moment that I don't have hair. So now you've literally blown my cover. But I'm interested in your – I know what my life's journey was. I'm interested in yours. Tell me how, in the first instance, you ended up as a journalist. I want to talk, by the way, about your new book, and we will do so at length because it's fascinating. But I want to talk about you first. Mm-hmm. How did you first enter journalism?
I actually can't remember, and I'll tell you why. I left university. I went to Cambridge. I did languages. I didn't like Cambridge. That was when my kind of very heavy drinking started to kick in, and
that alone would qualify you as a journalist.
At the time, it did, yeah, absolutely. But I then kind of bummed around for a year or so. I worked in a casino. I was a busker. I worked in a light bulb factory. I did all sorts of kind of just, I don't know, I just didn't know what I wanted to do. And I'd always been, I'd always loved writing. I'd always loved words. And we've got no journalism in my family at all. My father was a vet. And I applied for this training scheme. And there were, it's the Daily Mirror. I think there were 1,200 applicants for 9 places. It was something like that. It was really kind of competitive. And I got onto that, and it meant I had 2 years in local papers down in the West Country, which is the best grounding anybody can have, in my view, still. Mm-hmm. It's where I met Fiona, and we're still together. And that was it. And the minute I started being a journalist, I loved it. I think one of the best things about being a journalist is you can just go up to anybody and start talking to them. And 99 times out of 100, they'll talk to you.
Yeah.
And they've all got a story. And if you're in a local paper, everybody's a story. Doesn't have to be fury over, outrage over. It can just be who they are and what they do and what they think. And then I got into the Daily Mirror. I started as a freelance, worked in the Mirror, always wanted to work on the Mirror. I remember the interview. They said, which newspaper would you really like to work for? And it was one of those moments where the answer was the Mirror, but I saw this, they thought I should say the Guardian. And I just felt they were kind of Guardian people. So I said, well, obviously the Guardian. Oh, okay. And I could then realize I made a mistake. I said, no, that was bullshit. I really want to work for the Mirror. I worked for the Mirror. I then went into political coverage.
By choice, did you want to cover politics?
No, it kind of started. I wasn't that political at university. I wasted my time at university. I was just, I was a bit of a
joke. Yeah, I told you we had parallel lives.
Yeah, I was drinking very heavily. I was very anti the place. I used to get in a lot of trouble, a lot of fights, all that sort of stuff. I just had a huge chip on my shoulder. I'm not from a kind of remotely from a, you know, poor background, but I came from a northern town. My dad then had a really bad accident. He had to sell his practice and he joined the Ministry of Agriculture. We got moved to Leicester. I went to a school there that was a, you know, comprehensive school. I think I was the first kid from my school to go to Oxbridge. And I just got there and there were people like that. I did not know those sorts of people existed. They're now running my country again, I have to say.
Yes.
And I just got very, very chippy. So I wasn't that political. If anything, I was slightly anarchic. But when I got into the Mirror, I was always, I realized that actually I was very political and that these views were quite left of center. And then, so I wanted to do kind of what I would call social conscience type journalism. And then I wanted to do politics. And the Daily Mirror was the only paper that really supported the Labour Party, still is.
That's an interesting thing about Britain. I was over there, obviously. You and I worked a little bit together on this last campaign. The degree to which newspapers have political profiles is something that is not the same to that degree.
You have it more for television.
Yes.
Television, we have the BBC, and even the Independent and Sky and these guys, they're less strident than your television, whereas your newspapers tend to be very sober. And our newspapers, as you know full well, are pretty hysterical.
Yeah.
But the Daily Mirror then was I mean, here's the thing. When I started in the Westminster for the Mirror, we had two journalists whose full-time job was just covering the debates in Parliament. Even the broadsheets now have nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody. They have sketch writers who take the piss out of politicians. So, but that was, and then I got very friendly with Neil Kinnock. When he was leader of the Labour Party. And funny enough, Neil...
You were covering him and you got friendly with him?
I was totally open about it. Mm-hmm. I used to write it. I used to say...
I'm not saying that... That happens, you know.
Absolutely. No, I got... I, in fact, he was part of the reason that I wanted to go and cover politics. And...
Why? He's a charismatic fellow, right?
He's I'll tell you why, because I sort of felt, talking to him, that there was a... There was a passion there, and there were the things that really got him going were the things that got me going. And I think I reached a, I think it was around that time that I started to think, if you really want to make a difference, change things, this, you can do stuff in journalism. Of course you can, but actually you've got to get involved. So I had this hybrid phase where, to be absolutely frank, I wasn't really a proper journalist, not just because I was what I was writing. But there was a period when I was ghosting Gordon Brown's column in the Daily Record, a Scottish newspaper. I was helping him and Tony and Neil with speeches, with strategies. And now, my editor knew this and didn't mind.
Huh.
Because, as you say, it's a much more partisan environment. So I then left the Mirror. This was a kind of big mistake that I made. I was headhunted by... a new newspaper called Today. I was flattered into becoming the youngest news editor in Fleet Street. And I went to this paper and I was way out of my depths. I was now drinking very heavily. And that's when I had a pretty bad breakdown and ended up hospitalized. And so I was kind of out of the game for a while. And then the best thing that happened, though, was my former editor of The Mirror, who'd been really hacked off when I left, he phoned me up and he said, he literally said these words, "I hear you've gone mad." I said, "Well, I'm in hospital. I'll give you that." And he said, "Well, listen to me. You didn't listen to me before. Listen to me now." He said, "Stay there as long as you have to. Take the money from Today as long as you can. And when you're fit, come back here." And that was a fantastic.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary gesture.
Yeah. He ended up editing my diaries.
Oh, yeah, the Blair Diaries, which was a great, great book. Yeah. Let me stop you for a second and ask you about that period, mm-hmm. because you've written the Happy Depressive, and you've written extensively and spoken extensively about your experience, your struggles with mental illness, I presume alcoholism was a way of self-medicating to deal with that. What was the precipitant for all of that? And obviously your old boss called you and brought you back, but how much of a stigma did you feel? Because it was quite public, right, that you, you
were struggling. It's funny. I mean, I was, when I had the breakdown, the thing is that in the build-up to it, which went on for quite some time, that thing where when people are worried about you, you do have this thing where you think that they're the ones with the problem. So you're not really conscious of it. So my parents were worried. Fiona was really worried.
Your partner.
Yeah.
Did you have kids at the time?
No. Mm-hmm. No. Well, that's the best thing is that a year later we had our first kid. But so in the build-up to it, I suspect that I'd always had depression. But like you say, I think I drank a lot. And actually, if you just said to most people, oh, he's the life and soul of the party. He's going to be the last to fall down and he makes you laugh and he laughs. And so I wasn't really conscious of it. And when the breakdown happened.
What happened?
Oh, it was, again, it's just extraordinary how politics comes into it, all of it. So I go to this newspaper and the minute I walked through the door, I knew it was a mistake. They just weren't my sort of people. This guy was, he didn't want trade unions. He was just doing it for ego. And so I'm there. I'm the youngest news editor, blah, blah, blah. But I just didn't really want to be there. But I didn't want to admit I made a mistake. So I was drinking very heavily. I had, the day before the breakdown, I went, I'll tell you what, I mean, I'll talk you through the day. Because I remember this was when I said this to the psychiatrist when I was in hospital. This is when the penny dropped that I had a problem. Because loads of people have said to me, you've got an alcohol problem. And I'd say, don't be so absurd. I work, I can function, I can write better than you can. What are you talking about? So I went out, I'd got into a stage where I was waiting for Fiona has gone swimming every day of her life. And I was waiting for her to wake up in the morning. She'd go out to swim. I'd go to the bathroom. I'd throw up. And that would become every morning. I would then have a conversation.
Penny didn't drop then, huh?
No, not at all, because I felt better.
Yeah.
I felt better. And then I would go into, I would go to work and I would be having a conversation inside my head. When can I legitimately have a drink? And I'd say, well, midday's okay. But actually, you get to 20 past 11, you think, well, it's nearly midday. That's fine. So you put your jacket on your desk, you go over to the pub, you have a few drinks. That day, I ended up in the afternoon, I went out with a minister called David Mellor, Conservative government minister. And when I saw the receipts afterwards, when we were kind of trying to piece together what had happened, we got through four bottles of wine at lunch, and I think he had about two glasses. I then went to a drinking club. I then went back to work for a couple of hours. I had a terrible row with Fiona on the phone. I slammed down the phone and said I wasn't going home. I booked her to a hotel. And I demolished the minibar. Next day, I had to go to Scotland with Neil Kinnock for a piece that I was putting together. And where was the first place we were going to? We got to Scotland, Gordon Brown's constituency. This is back in 1986, before Gordon's, you know, what he was, what Gordon. He became. Yeah.
Yes.
Would you believe that the actual calamity of the breakdown began as we were visiting a nuclear base? It's not a good place to have a breakdown. I,
at least you weren't in charge.
Oh my God, honestly, it was just, I had a hire car. I was driving around this roundabout. I must have driven around 100 times. I couldn't get off the roundabout. Round and round and round. I was starting to hear voices. I was starting to hear music. I dumped the car. I phoned my office. I said, I've left this car in the car park of a nuclear base. I've given the keys to a guy called Sammy. Deal with it. Put the phone down. I've lost Neil. I've lost Gordon. They've moved on. I get a cab to Perth, which is about, I don't know, a long way away. By now, I can feel I'm really, really not well. I ended up catching them up. I was in a council building. And I was starting to feel so odd that I think I've got to phone home. So I said to this guy, he said, where I can use a telephone. This is pre-mobile phones. He said, yeah, you come to this office. I go into this office, pick up the phone. I phone Fiona, no reply. That's strange. I phone my mum, no reply. I phone my brother, no reply. I phone my friend, no reply. I phone all the numbers I can remember in my head. I phone them. Nobody's in. Of course, it was an office. Every time I was hitting zero to dial the first number, I was going through to the operator. It was a Friday night. Nobody was on. So I'm just hearing these. So now I'm really spiraling out of control. I walk down these stairs. Don't ask me why, but I start to empty my pockets on the floor. I had a bag with me. I start to divest myself. And I think what I was doing, by now I think that I'm being tested. And if I fail the test, I'm going to die. That's what I think. I put everything in all the possessions on the floor. And then at this point, because Neil Kinnock's now on the other side of the building, he's making a speech. And it was the weekend that Olof Palme...
He was the leader of the Labour Party.
But it was the weekend that Olof Palme, the Swedish Prime Minister, was assassinated. So there was quite a lot of security around Neil. There was a sort of sudden upping of security around left-wing leaders. And next thing I know, two special branch guys came over. And one of them just said to me, are you okay? And I said, I don't think I am, no. And he said, do you think you should come with us? And I said, I think I should. And I went off with them. I took me to the police station. I was in a cell. I took all my clothes off. I started banging the wall. Eventually, they got a doctor in. Patricia Hewitt, who later was a cabinet minister, then Neil's press secretary. She then realised I'd vanished. They'd been worried about me all day. She phoned the police. You know, we're trying to find this guy, Alistair Campbell, he's a journalist. So she said to them, look, he is who he says he is. So, but they'd only let me go if I went to hospital. And I went to hospital and then sedated and all that stuff.
And that started a lifelong effort, I guess you would call it, to deal with these forces in yourself and so on.
Well, you know what? They told me to stop drinking, which I did. And that wasn't easy, but I went 13 years without a drink, without any drink at all. I have the occasional drink more, but the thing is that I got really angry because I stopped drinking, which I thought was going to be I was going to be fine, but then of course the depressions were still there, and. You know, I could go long periods without them, but then suddenly they'd hit and I'd be on the floor. Absolutely on the floor.
So how did you emerge from all of that? This was prior to your whole life in public life. You ended up being the principal strategist, a message strategist for Tony Blair, a towering figure in British political history. How did you get from there?
Well, I went back to journalism. I went back to the Mirror. And Richard, my old editor, wisely, I think, he said, you're going to have to start at the bottom again. I was doing the night watch, reporter. My very first job, when I was back, I actually had to phone a friend to file for me because I had a panic attack. It was a terrorist thing at Heathrow Airport, and I had a panic attack. And I phoned my friend, Sid Young, guy down in Bristol. I said, Sid, I'm first day back. I can't do it, and I don't want them to know. And you know what journalists and I am. They're friends. They're great.
Right.
He did it for me, filed him, you know, helped me file it. And so, but I just built myself day by day. I got stronger. And then I started to want to get back into the political beat. I became political correspondent, then political editor, got a column. I was chief leader writer. And then when John Smith died, and then I started to have a bit of a broadcast career as well. I was doing things on the BBC. I had a slot, regular slot, reviewing the newspapers. And one morning when I was reviewing the newspapers, I'd get driven to the BBC, do this thing, and then get driven to the office. And I'm driving to the office, phone goes, and it's Hilary Kaufman, who was John Smith, Tony's predecessor as Labour leader, his spokesman. She said, have you heard about John? I said, no, what? She said, well, he's not well. And they knew that I'd get asked to do a lot of media, and I could tell by the tone of her voice, he was probably dead. And so it was the most extraordinary thing. And every time I go by the Marylebone, the West, on the Westway, where every time I go there, I think of this because it was one of those moments in your life. I knew Tony Blair was going to be the leader, and I knew I'd work for him, even though we'd never discussed it. Tony didn't ask me straight away, but he did eventually, and I said no. Partly, to be honest, because I had had the Breda. Partly because...
And he knew that too.
He knew that. Partly also because Fiona didn't want me to do it. My parents didn't want me to do it. We had kids now. We just had our third child had just been born, a baby. So two young boys and a daughter. And anyway, Tony has got very, very fine instinct. So I went, he sort of badgered me for a while. And we were coming up to the summer holiday. He's now a leader. Coming up to the summer holiday, and he asked me to go to see him, and he really turned on the whole kind of charm and the rest of it. And he said, look, I really want you to do this. I don't want you just to be a spokesman. There are many people who've got a strategic mind. I think you've got a strategic mind. I really want you to be part of it. Da-da-da. I said, well, look, you know the score. I'm worried about my past. I'm worried about things I've done in my past that are going to become newsworthy, you know, but embarrassing for you. I'm worried about Fiona. I'm worried about the family. I'm going to take my time. I'm going to take a month. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but don't badger me because that's what I'm going to do. So I went on holiday.
Were you worried about your own capacity to handle the pressures associated?
Yeah. I mean, I had a breakdown. I'd had a complete psychotic collapse.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, back to the show.
We went on holiday, and we used to go on holiday with the Kinnocks. Neil and Glenys and Fiona were all united in thinking, I shouldn't do it. Okay, so the whole holiday. Tony had an instinct, so he phones me up. He said, listen, we're only a couple hundred miles away. I think, should we pop over?
Just a couple hundred miles away.
Should we just pop over?
Yes.
So he came over, and I'll never forget this. I wrote this in my diary. I don't think Cherise forgiven me. They came, and she was carrying a black dustbin liner with clothes and some raw carrots at the bottom. I've never understood what the carrots were for. So I've got Neil and Glenys and Fiona in one room trying to talk me out of it, and I've got Tony and Cherise in the other.
Neil being the former leader.
Huh? Neil being the former leader, yeah. And this went on for a few days. And then and the mother-in-law, Tony's mother.
Must have gone through all the carrots, huh?
Tony's mother-in-law was there. She had to go back home. So I was just wanted to get away. I said, I'll drive you to the airport. Tony said, I'll come too. And on the way back from the airport, I thought, right, by now I've kind of decided I'm going to do it. Okay. But I said to him, listen, I know you know I had a breakdown. I know you know that I've had a drink problem. I know you know that I get depression, but I really need to tell you. So I told him in even more grisly, graphic detail than I just told you about what happened, about what was going on inside my head, about how difficult it was, about having to take medication, about, you know, about stuff that I'd done in my past that, you know, when I was a journalist, nobody cared. But the minute I became Tony Blair's right-hand man, old stuff became newsworthy.
And did it become newsworthy?
Yeah. Day one, I'd written pornography, fights, things I'd said when I'd been drunk, just, you know. But he didn't mind. And I think that, and when I became an ambassador for the Time to Change campaign, which is all about trying to change attitudes to mental illness, they did a poster campaign on the metro, on the tube, And it was just the exchange that Tony and I had that I'd talked about in an interview where I said, look, you know about my breakdown. You know about the drink problem. And Tony said, I'm not bothered if you're not bothered. And I said, what if I'm bothered? And he said, I'm still not bothered.
That was a poster.
Yeah. Yeah. So that exchange was a poster.
How did you feel about that?
Good. Good. Because I feel I've never, it's interesting when you talk about stigma, I've met so many people for whom the stigma is often worse than the symptoms.
Yeah.
But I don't know why, but I never felt it personally. I actually, once I got through my breakdown, once I rebuilt, once I got to that phase where every day I was feeling a bit stronger, I actually started to say to myself, this is the best thing that you've ever done. You should be really proud of how you've come through this. And so, and then the other thing that happened, when the media first started to phone me and say, we're writing a piece about your breakdown, we're writing a piece about what you used to do when you were drunk. And I could have done, and it was one of those moments where it was an instinctive judgment. I could, and part of my mind was thinking, just tell them to F off. And this
is a podcast. You can say whatever you want.
Okay, just fuck off and leave me alone. This is the past. It's got nothing to do with you. It's got nothing to do with what I do now. I could have done that, but my instinct was just talk about it. And I've done that ever since.
Yeah, I admire you for it. You know, you and I have talked about this. I had a father who committed suicide, and I didn't talk about it for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to come to grips with why I didn't want to talk about it. And I didn't want to talk about it because I was embarrassed, and I thought it might sully his memory if I talked about it.
Yeah.
And I realized that was exactly why he never went to get help.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a piece about it, and the reaction to that was stronger than anything I've ever done. And I imagine that you being as public about your struggles was encouraging to people who were going through some of the same problems.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll tell you the other thing, but I mean, as you know, from having been in London and seeing how our press operate, I get a lot of bad press still. But in this area, the media has been good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I think there is everybody knows somebody who's had a breakdown. Everybody knows somebody who's got a drinking problem. Everybody knows somebody who's got depression or bipolar or schizophrenia, whatever it might be. And I think I just reached a point of thinking, if you've been through that experience and you're not ashamed of it, which I'm not, and you feel that it has made you stronger, which it has, and you feel that you can help other people and you can change attitudes, then I think you have a responsibility to do it. And I get messages from people literally every day. Every day. I get people, I call them the whisperers. You know, you'll do a talk, I'll do a talk, and then there'll be a Q&A, and you'll talk about this, that, and the other, and Blair, and Bush, and the Queen, and, you know, politics, and blah, 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 blah. And at the end, you've done these things. You get people come up and they want to sign a book or just have a picture or a chat or whatever. And I can always spot these people coming a mile off, and I call them the whisperers. There'll be a little queue left at the end, and they'll come up and they'll just come and they'll tap me and they'll say, thanks for talking about mental health.
Uh-huh.
And I'll say, why are you whispering? Because you don't need to whisper.
Uh-huh.
And I'll say, why are you whispering? And she said, oh, well, I've got a dad, I've got a mum, I've got a brother, I've got a sister, I've got a boyfriend. You know, they don't want to talk about it.
Right.
And I say, and I'll just say, talk about it.
Right.
And I'll tell you the other thing, in government, I mean, you know this as well as I do. I mean, at the moment, you take the National Health Service in the UK, the government austerity and all that, massive pressure on spending, because of the stigma. Mental health services go to the bottom.
It's the first thing that gets assaulted.
Not cancer. It used to be cancer, yeah. The big C. Nobody could talk about cancer. So I just think, and the other thing to say is, I think it is changing. I do think attitudes are changing. Politicians in the UK now feel they have to say there must be parity of esteem and understanding between health and mental and physical health. It's not happening, but they feel they have to say it. Well, that's a start.
Yeah. Well, I really admire you for you're a great role model. And you still struggle with these things.
Well, I'm quite lucky because I've after years and years and years and years. The other thing, I suppose this is where I was the victim of stigma. When I was in Downing Street, I didn't see a psychiatrist. I saw my doctor. I had a GP, a general practitioner. He kept my notes in a safe in his house because he was convinced the press were trying to get hold of them. And I didn't see a psychiatrist. I've seen a psychiatrist a lot since I left, and I've now found various medication, exercise really important, and ways of dealing with it
mm-hmm.
that mean that I haven't touch wood, had a really bad bout for probably a few months.
I must say that having served in the White House, I think every senior official in government should go and find a therapist, because the pressures that you face.
Certainly, whether it's a therapist or it's, I mean, I see a guy now who's a sports psychologist, and I met him actually through writing about sport for the book, and I now use him because he's brilliant at preparing to deal with high pressure moments. He's actually the.
And he's taken a minute off your mile too?
No.
Let me ask you, I want to get into your book. I want to ask you about Tony Blair. It says something about him that he embraced you as he did and recognized you for the talent that you are. Talk about his talent. You've just written a book that's essentially about leadership. The title is Winners and How They Succeed, but it's really about leadership in many ways. Obviously, Tony Blair was a winner. What made him a winner, and how did you guys transform what was in many ways a moribund Labour Party at the time that he took over as leader?
Yeah, well, I first spotted, I was a journalist. Fiona's brother, Gavin, is a lawyer. And after the election in 83, Gavin said to me, "Watch out for this guy, Tony Blair, really smart, really good guy, really clever, really funny."
You knew him as a lawyer.
Yeah. And so when a new parliament starts, when I was a political journalist, you used to just hang around the central lobby and try and recognize the new faces. And I actually don't have a good memory. It's one of the reasons I keep a diary. But I do remember my first meeting with Tony. He was wearing a truly hideous beige suit. He's always been bad at clothes. And I promise you, within a minute of meeting, I introduced myself. And of course, the dynamic, I was political editor of the Daily Mirror. The dynamic, he was a young MP. He needed me more than I needed him, kind of thing.
Right.
So he was kind of charming and nice and, you know. But within a minute, we were talking about the modernization of the Labour Party. We need to do more. We need to go faster. And we just got on very, very well. I was probably closer to Gordon at the start, though.
Gordon Brown.
Yeah, because Gordon was more... He was making more waves. He was creating more news. And like I said to you earlier, I used to help him write his column. But Tony, I'll tell you what he had. What Tony always had was an ability to see beyond the bubble in which politics spends so much of his time. He was always just had that reach out to the public. And it wasn't just about being a good communicator. It was also about understanding the importance of politics is about people. It's not about politicians. And I think too many politicians forget that.
And so talk about, for one second, why is it that he emerged? Brown is a powerful intellect, really manifestly so. Why did Tony Blair essentially eclipse him in the leadership of the Labour Party?
I think people sense that he had a broader appeal. And they had some of the... I remember my mother used to be, she died a couple of years ago, but I remember she used to say, "I think Gordon would have been a fantastic politician in the radio age." Gordon didn't like the modern stuff. For Tony, it just came naturally. But they see, I think both Tony and Bill Clinton suffer partly for being such good communicators. Because people want to think that's what they are. But actually, Tony was always very, very good at forward thinking, at strategy, very good at... I mean, in the book, I write about the Holy Trinity being strategy, leadership, and teamship.
Yes.
And strategy to me is the most important. I say it's God, and I think strategy is the most important thing. Leadership, obviously, is fundamental. But teamship... You know, you were part of Barack Obama's team. Barack Obama was a formidable candidate. We couldn't do it on his own. Nelson Mandela was one of the most amazing people of our lifetime, but he needed people around him. And I think Tony had this ability not just to get good people and get very different people as well. When we were in working with Ed Miliband at the last election, and I don't want this to sound boastful, But when I was comparing the teams, and, you know, whether it was Jonathan Powell, who was Tony's chief of staff, or Peter Mandelson, Derry Irvin, Angie Hunter, Sally Morgan, Peter Hyman, I could go on and on, Andrew Donis, Pat McFadden, David Miliband. There were people there. We were all very different. We were all, you know, we all had our egos and all the rest of it, but we really, really, really wanted to make it work for this guy. And that was, and I you know, sometimes when I did get very down, which I did, and I always felt that it was worth digging a bit deeper to try to do the job that I had to do to try and help him win. And that's something, that's a leadership skill. It's about making people want to go that extra bit.
What about getting people to work together as a unit?
And the teamship. You see, we are, when Tony left office in 2007, he had a dinner at Chequers for the original 1994 team. And, okay, Peter and I had had a few fights along the way and a few big fallouts, and there were other people there that didn't get on maybe as well as they did, but we were still very, very close. And Jonathan Powell and I, for example, Jonathan was chief of staff, I was director of communications and strategy. We never had a crossword. I didn't want to do his job, he didn't want to do my job. Actually, one of the things I read in, I remember in David Plouffe's book about your campaign, which I've quoted in mine, was that he talked about very early on Obama rewarding, not, I mean, rewarding as in money, but boosting people who had good ideas and they worked. But it all, but the sense of the team being really.
Well, I can tell you that the first meeting we ever had, he gave us three rules. And the first was, it was going to be a ground up campaign because that was the only kind of campaign that could produce change. But the second was, we're a team, we're a unit. And we're going to rise and fall together. We're going to rely on each other because we believe in what we're doing. And anybody leaking or undermining other people, they're going to go because
we're. See, I think I've said in the book that I think that when it came to the whole New Labour thing, I mean, people forget we won a third election after Iraq. I don't think we lost in the end in 2010 and beyond because of policy or because the Conservatives had a better positioning or beliefs. We lost because of failures of teamship. The Tony Gordon thing became untenable. I'm afraid, I think Gordon did have a
he was Chancellor of the Exchequer.
He was a Chancellor who wanted to be Prime Minister, which is a perfectly noble thing to want to be, but for large parts it rendered the government dysfunctional, and that's a failure of teamship.
Let me ask you about the Iraq question, because Americans will be interested in this. That seems to be a demerit in the minds of a lot of folks in Britain, that Blair was so supportive of George W. Bush and the Iraq policy. Was that a mistake?
Well, look, if you look at, go back to 2003 and what we were saying about what we hoped Iraq would become, and look at Iraq now, and can anybody be happy with the way that's panned out? Of course not. But the reason why I still defend Tony over it is because so much of the history on it has been rewritten. Tony, yes, there were points where he said, for us to break from the United States on a fundamental issue of foreign policy is a very, very big thing to do. But he did believe it was the right thing, regardless of that relationship, because he was and still is worried that the real threat facing the world is this notion of a rogue state capable of producing weapons of mass destruction that fall into the hands of terrorist organizations who did the kind of thing that started, that led to the war in Afghanistan, and I guess ultimately to the war in Iraq, namely 9/11. And that was the frame.
And he believed that they had them.
So did I. So did I, based on the stuff that he was seeing every day, which we also knew that the French president was seeing. And now, were there times when, and this has been recorded, because, you know, everything any of us have ever said about this, we've had to put out into inquiries, and I had to hand over my diaries. And so there were times when I think some of us felt a little bit uncomfortable that, less Bush actually, but Cheney and Rumsfeld in particular were just pushing this so hard, and But you see, Tony, I remember he was having a conversation with Jack Straw, who was the Foreign Secretary at the time, and Jack was making the point, look, these guys will understand if they have to go it alone, because they were going to do it. And Tony says, Jack, you just got to understand, I believe in this. I think this is what we should be doing. So, and your word, demerit, yes, there's no doubt that people hold that against him. It's funny, you still do meet people who support him, but there's no doubt that it's one of the reasons why in a matter of 8 years, he's gone from a position where he was the first prime minister ever to get a standing ovation in the House of Commons as he left it, to now in the recent Labour leadership election, whenever he made an intervention, it was deemed to help Jeremy Corbyn. That's sad.
Jeremy Corbyn, the new...
the new, Labour, very, leader, yeah, yeah.
Quite left.
Yeah. Left of Bernie.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to the show. The book is called Winning.
Winners,
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
But this is the reason I made the transition there, or the mistake, is that I am thinking about politics and how much winning should be prized, because it's easy in politics, and this is what I've always been confronted with, all of us in politics are, we have access to polling, we have access to research, it's here's where the public is, if you take this position, you have a better chance to win. Where do you draw the line and say, well, that may be the best way to win, but I don't think that's the right thing for the country.
But I think...
It's a little different than sports.
It is different. Of course it's different. I mean, I think there are similarities. And I also think there are things that politics can learn from sport. Sport uses data better than politics does.
Yeah.
Sport, the best of Billy Beane, Formula One, the top cycling guys, these guys use data way better than we do because they use it to drive innovation. We tend to use data for confirmation bias. I think getting the balance right between data and instinct is but you see, the thing
what
is-
about principle?
Hugely important. And you see, I think that we got this reputation for the polls and spin and what have you. But we've just been talking about Iraq. It's a very good example of where, look, Tony knew it was incredibly unpopular. He's sitting in his house in Downing Street, sitting in his flat. You're looking at a million British people out on a march. And I have a golden rule.
So he took that as a hint, huh?
He knew. And I have a golden rule that if there's one person on a march, probably 20 thought about going. So he knew. And I think even on... We were not actually poll-led. Way less than other politicians I've seen.
But I'm not asking this in the context of Blair. I'm asking this really in a we just saw, for example, here in the American race, Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State, was very bullish on this Trans-Pacific Partnership, announced that she now is against it. And it's not popular. And Bernie Sanders, who's running against it, is strongly opposed to it. And the supposition is, obviously she put it in the context of policy, but the supposition was this was a political decision. Where do you draw the line here?
What I say in the book about political strategy, I think in any big thing, you have to be very clear about your objective. And wanting to win in politics, that is a totally justified, noble objective. The strategy is the hard bit. And that is where you have to be really clear about what it is that you're trying to do. And the tactics should always come below those two. And I think the pressures of the modern age, 24/7 news, social media, the noise, the volume of noise around politics all the time, I think it makes politicians far too tactical. And
this is why people are so hungry for authenticity.
Yeah. And it's so Jeremy Corbyn, who I think is not the right leader for the Labour Party, and I think will really struggle to connect with the British public. But he captured this sense of people just wanting something different. I mean, Donald Trump, I think the idea of Donald Trump even being the nominee, let alone becoming president, is bad for America. But he's tapping into that sense of we want something different.
Has it been processed, by the way, in Europe?
Well, the Trump thing?
Yes.
I guess just a slightly downscale version of how it's been here. I think that certainly in the context of the UK, because Jeremy Corbyn was on the rise, Bernie Sanders and Trump are both seen as part of this rise of, as you say, the authentic.
See, I wanted to ask you one. Earlier this year, when the race was going on in Britain, we saw really last summer the rise of Nigel Farage and UKIP.
Yeah.
For a while, he was in many ways preaching the same platform as Trump: nativism, nationalism, anti-trade, anti-immigrant. And I think it's not a coincidence that this is a kind of a consequence of the modern economy. There's an opening for
definitely
kind of demagogic appeal.
But especially in Europe, where there's been, you know, look at it. Every night you sit on the news and these pictures of migrants coming in, and you have prime ministers like David Cameron talk about them swarming across Europe. And, you know, it's an easy platform for a right-wing demagogue. But I think that what's interesting about Farage is ultimately
he collapsed.
Yeah, he didn't break through.
Yes.
And that's because I think the public, they take a judgment over time. And of course, in your politics, which is so brutal and so tough
and so long, yes,
then I can't see Trump.
No, I've said repeatedly, I said, you know, these things go in phases. He did well in the, he's, you know, a impresario of beauty contests. He's done well in the swimsuit competition. Yeah. When the talent rounds come, can be more difficult.
Yeah.
And I think as you get closer to the election, people look for more solidity, more sobriety.
I'll tell you what I'm a little bit worried about. I mean, I've only been here a few days this time, but I don't get the sense that many Americans take into account the fact that this election matters way beyond America. And it feels quite domestic. Whereas actually, you're talking about a position of global leadership. So if you look at the Republican side, for example, whether it's the doctor or it's the Hewlett-Packard lady who screwed up there, or it's Trump, all three of them, no real experience of office at all. It's quite scary.
You look at polling in the Republican Party, being an outsider is very much valued among the candidates. It's less in the Democratic Party.
Well, that's because they do this anti-politics, anti-government thing the whole time.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, you see, when I look at them all, if I look at Hillary, I can imagine Hillary as a president. Funny enough, I was on Morning Joe this morning and Bernie had been on before. So I was watching him quite closely and I was more impressed than I thought I was going to be because he's got very clear, simple messages. You've got a nice manner.
Yeah.
But I can't see, just as I can't see Jeremy Corbyn, I can't see the British people, those who aren't in the bubble, going for Jeremy Corbyn. I'm not sure America's going to go for that.
Let's just talk for one sec. You coined the phrase New Labour, and it was meant to be a line of demarcation with a Labour Party that people had felt had drifted too far to the left. What now for the Labour Party, now that it's cast its lot firmly with Corbyn, and what's the way forward there?
Do you know, I mean, for the first time in my life, I don't know. I think it's, I was genuinely taken aback. I'll tell you a funny, I'll tell you a story about the day after the election, May the 7th, and I can't mute, I think you'd gone, and I was being dragged, as everybody was, into the media to talk about what it meant. If I was the first person on the BBC.
This was after Ed Miliband's defeat.
After the defeat. So, and the morning after, before Ed had announced he was stepping down, but I knew that he was going to do that, I was dragged into a tent on College Green opposite the House of Parliament with two microphones just like this. And who was at the other microphone but Jeremy Corbyn? If I'd have said on air that day, Jeremy, I think you were the next leader, you know. He and everybody else would have thought I'd gone completely crazy again. But it happened. And so I've lost my bearings. And I was always seen as being to the left of Tony Blair, to the left of Peter Mandelson. And I am. I'm really driven first by winning and then by trying to, you know, do good things as a government. But I see, so Jeremy's won. I don't particularly want to slag him off or say some of the things I said before he was elected. But I just don't see where these people that we lost, yes, we're getting all these new activists back. Fine, that's great. And I love all the kind of new passion and the energy, and that's fantastic. But I spend a lot of time going around the country, and the sort of people I just bump into when I'm going to see my football team, or soccer, by the way.
Yes.
I'm going to see my football team.
Thank you.
Or I'm going in a queue at the cinema or whatever. And you just get people the whole time saying, what on earth have you done? And meanwhile, the Conservatives, not a particularly good prime minister, not a particularly good government in my view. Cameron's just made a speech just kind of trying to colonise the centre ground. Perfectly sensible politics, but we've kind of opened the door to that.
So in your book, Winners and How They Succeed, the people you talk about, and they're in business and they're in politics and they're in sports and they're across a whole range of pursuits and fashion, you say there are a fair few tortured souls in here, but that's partly what gives them their special hyper-achieving qualities, which they put to greater use in their chosen field. Fear of failure, fear of not achieving.
Definitely. I think the only person in the book who, because I asked a lot of them the same questions, the only person in the book who says he never thinks about losing is Mayweather. I would say a lot of the sports people, there's a soccer coach, Arsene Wenger, he says, every defeat leaves a scar on my soul. And you can see that when you see him on the touchline. He's not happy. And even if they score a goal, he's happy for a few seconds. And then he's on to the next worry. I think that actually that fear of failure, there's a wonderful, I know cricket is not a big thing in America, but there's a Pakistani fast bowler called Wasim Akram. And I said to him, again, the question I asked a lot of them, what's the thing that takes you from being really, really good at what you do to being the best, really great? He's one of the greatest bowlers ever. And he said, it's knowing the difference between wanting to win and will to win. Everybody wants to win. Will to win is what makes you do the things that drive you, the sacrifices, the diet, the sleep, the exercise, the not having a glass of wine with dinner, all the stuff you've got to do, the planning, the preparation, the innovation, the fear that you're going to get left behind.
Yeah, when Obama ran for president or was thinking of running for president, I said, my fear for you is I think you're too normal. I don't think you're pathological enough to run for president, because I know these other people, they'll drag themselves out of bed 20-hour days under every circumstance because they have to be president and they don't want to fail. And he said, you know, I you're right. I don't, but he said, but I'm very competitive. And if I get in, you know, but I've never known him in all the years I've worked with him to be fearful of failure. And that's allowed him to make decisions
well, that's
and not
great.
Look back.
That's great. But
I just think it's very unusual. I've never figured out why.
He's obviously got an equilibrium that's incredibly useful to him in what he does. And see, Tony's like that. Tony Blair was like that and also very, very optimistic. But there were definitely points at which he and I and some of the other people around him, we would be pressing the fear buttons in each other. I'll give you an example where I can remember several times Tony Blair saying to me, if we don't sort this out, we're dead. Now, I wrote about that in the book in the context of Lance Armstrong, because Lance Armstrong, he said that one of the most, this is before he was kind of exposed as, and finally, you know, his reputation really got trashed. But I'd interviewed him several times. And I said to him, when you were ill with cancer, were you scared? He said, yeah, I was scared. I said, and now here you are about to face Jan Ullrich in a bike race. This was for his fifth tour win. Are you scared of losing? He says, yeah. And I said, what's worse, losing a bike race or dying from cancer? He said, losing and dying is the same thing.
Yeah.
Now,
I heard Bill Clinton give a eulogy for Sergeant Shriver, in which he said, "The only thing worse than losing than dying is losing an election."
Wow,
I thought that was a really mean.
But I've got to say, I mean, I was less emotionally involved in the last campaign, but the three with Tony in particular, I've got to be honest, I used to make myself scared. We used to have, Philip Gould and I used to have meetings where we'd sit down and we'd say, right, if we were the Tories and we knew everything about us that we know, what would we do with it? And you can scare yourself.
Yeah. You have to go through that exercise. Look, I think part of the job of being a strategist is to game out all those options.
Absolutely.
And part of the motivation is for the strategist but the candidate, you know, in our case, Obama was the guy who picked us all up when we got knocked down. He was always recognized.
But that's a great way to be. No, they're all different. But you see, and Tony had that role. He could kind of keep us all up when we're down, and sometimes the other way around. But, you know, I've written the book about, we talked earlier about mental health and mental illness. I think this thing about the extreme mind, I think a lot of extreme, look, Lincoln was depressive, Churchill was depressive, Martin Luther King was bipolar. I think that the extreme mind is often driven by fear. And I've got to be honest, some of the best work that I ever did, whether it was strategizing or writing or speech writing, whatever it might be, some of the best stuff I ever did came when I was either exhausted or scared. Waking up in the middle of the night, totally unable to sleep, and just going out for a run.
I've been there.
Going out for a run. And you know, ideas coming into your head. Now, some of them would be crap, right? But sometimes, and that would be right. Because you were scared.
Right.
You're waking up because you were scared.
Yeah, so it's really a question of how you channel that anxiety.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, we're both sports nuts. That's one of, I think you call it sport. I call it sports.
I call it sport.
But I was, and just last night, I was, as we sit here, I was in Pittsburgh watching my Cubs play the Pirates.
The
they're
people,
my Cubs now because
the
they won, brother. Now they're my Cubs. And they have this wonderful manager, Joe Maddon, who's taken them from a very mediocre team to a potentially
– He should be my next addition.
I want to recommend that. Honestly, he's an incredible –
I've got Joe Torre.
Yeah, I was sitting right behind him at the game last night. Yeah.
He's
the real deal.
Amazing guy.
But so just give me 60 seconds on what makes a great manager or coach in either sport or sports.
You know what? A lot of them are the same qualities that makes good leaders in politics. They're strategic. My main profile in the book on strategy is Jose Mourinho, the manager of Chelsea. Now, he's actually going through a hard time at the moment, but he's very strategic. They set big goals. They work incredibly hard. They're obsessed and fascinated by the process. That's what makes them do it again and again and again and again. They innovate. That's what, again, another thing they do better than politics does. They innovate. They keep looking to the next thing. They're never happy with the last win. Jose Mourinho, one year when he won the Premier League title, he got his medal, he threw it in the crowd. People thought it was showmanship, but actually he was saying, I'm on to the next thing. Dave Brailsford, who's the cycling coach who built the first ever British team to win the Tour de France, his team to this day will say the guy didn't even let us celebrate. And the reason was we had the Olympics 2 weeks later. You're on to the next one. And I think the other thing is they're resilient. So the winner, there's a great quote from an athletics coach. He's an Irish guy who coaches the Kenyan athletics team called Colm O'Connell. And he says, the winner is the loser who evaluates defeat properly. Well, back to what we talked about in New Labour, that's what we tried to do. That's what the New Democrats did in trying to, you know, if you've been rejected, if the public are pushing you away, how do we get back? And so I say to people in business and politics, don't just enjoy sport. Don't just sponsor it. Don't just get the gold medalists into the White House or the Elysee or Downing Street because they've, you know, they've represented the country and done well. Go and look at how they do what they do. I've learned so much, even from Floyd Mayweather, who I know people may not like. But I tell you what, the way that guy prepares for a fight.
49 wins. He's no defeats.
He's incredible.
Well, listen, your book, Winners and How They Succeed, is filled with interesting case studies, and there's a lot to learn from.
You're in it. You're in it with a great quote. Conventional wisdoms are almost always wrong.
Yeah, those are the words that I live by. but Alistair Campbell has written 10 other books as well. Every one of them is worth reading, and I so appreciate being with you and your friendship. And I look forward to books 12 through 20.
Thank you for listening to the Axe Files, brought to you by the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Miriam Fender Annenberg. The show is also produced by Saralina Berry, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Steve Lichtai and Haley Thomas. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.